Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, where we live a life of luxury. You go from Trent Horn to Jimmy Akin. Come on. It's just gift after gift. Going from glory to glory here at Catholic Answers Live. Your calls are welcome. It'll be open forum this hour. So if you have a question about the Catholic faith in any part of the Catholic faith, you're welcome to call. And of course, Jimmy's here, so the other category is everything else. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Welcome back, Jimmy.
Thank you very much, Cy Kelly. Glad to be back.
I've had the great pleasure of working with you quite a bit this week. I hope it hasn't been too much of a strain on you, but I sure enjoy it.
Yeah, no, as I told you before, I have a high tolerance level for Cy Kellett.
I know. I wish more people did. I really do wish more people did. The number 888-318-7884. Tomorrow, telepathic.
Today. You're dislocated. You're Billy Pilgrim. You become unstuck in time.
Right.
Yeah, no. Today, we had an episode release about the gospel of Jesus's wife.
Oh, and that's today. Okay.
Yeah.
I am completely unstuck in time. You're correct. Okay. Yeah. All right. So the gospel of Jesus's wife.
Right. It's already out and it's getting really good reviews in the comments. One person said it may be the most fascinating episode of Mysterious World he's heard, in his opinion.
That's good. A good story and a good storyteller. That's a good show.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I endeavor to do quality work.
888-318-7884, the number here. If you want to see Jimmy's episode on the gospel of Jesus's wife or on anything else, there's hundreds of episodes at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Just go to mysterious.fm or type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World or Jimmy Akin, or you know how to do it. 888-318-7884, every line full. So off we go to Joseph in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Joseph, welcome. Thank you for starting us off this hour. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, Jimmy. I suppose you guys are familiar with someone by the name of Michael Voris, who founded the Church Militant.
Yes.
From what I gather, he's gained a fairly reputable reputation, and in
some circles, perhaps.
Yeah, right. Well, I guess he's reportedly fallen back into his sin and had to remove himself as the founder of Church Militant. Although, as bad as that was, you know, not only for him, but for the rest of us, because I was kind of floored by how it all happened. But
Joseph, I don't have any knowledge of that situation beyond what was publicly announced. And it was announced by Church Militant that there had been some kind of moral issue that Michael Voris had engaged in, and that it was determined that it was best for him to step back. But they didn't really go into any detail beyond that, citing grounds of privacy, and I respect that. You know, one can speculate what may have happened, but that would just be speculation. And really, this is a matter that's private to Michael Voris, and, you know, I don't see any need to inquire into it any further. I believe in respecting people's privacy. The matter has already been dealt with, and so I would leave it at that.
And I just wanted to point out.
Well, Joseph, if I may, do you have a question for Jimmy? Rather than pointing things out, if you've got a question, we'd love to do that.
Well, yeah, I guess my question was, that should not have taken away from the accuracy and validity of his reporting.
Okay.
Where he supposedly, you know, he reported on the Vatican, where they were holding satanic rituals, and then he's also called out the U.S. Catholic bishops.
It's starting to feel just like a long statement, Joseph, and I apologize for that, but it's a question and answer show. So
since Joseph raised issues reportedly connected with what Michael Voris reported on, and this is something I'm not a regular viewer of Church Militant, so I don't know what Michael Voris or others may or may not have said. But I would say one of the reasons that I'm not a regular viewer of Church Militant is that I have not found its reporting to be particularly accurate. And so so I would look at anything that news, I look at everything that every news source reports with a certain degree of caution, but I would look at what Church Militant has reported with an even greater degree of caution, because I find that its coverage tends to be slanted and not accurate in many cases. There are situations of repeating rumors rather than things that can be rigorously documented, and like any claims of people engaging in satanic activity at the Vatican, well, that kind of goes into the rumor category, because they're certainly not doing anything like that openly. And, you know, there are fallen people in every institution, including the Vatican, and maybe some of them did something they shouldn't that involved Satan, but I have no proof of that. And it's a sensationalistic enough rumor that I think we need to view it with great caution, because it's very easy to believe things that are sensationalistic, even when they're not well-founded. And I would put that in this, I would put this in that category. I would say it's sensationalistic reporting based on rumors, and I think we need a double dose of caution in approaching anything like that. And I hope that helps you, Joseph.
Thank you, Joseph. Going to keep moving. Up next, Johnny is in Michigan. Johnny, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
I wanted to say thank you very much for seeing Pope Peter today, and wanted to say thank you to Edgar for a prayer he gave me today.
Oh, so praise God. Edgar's a good man. Well, we're glad you got the prayer and the book, Johnny.
I got a quick question to ask Jimmy, though.
Yes, you're on the air with Jimmy.
Jimmy, what is the difference between a Melkite Catholic Church with a gold dome and a cross on it and the Catholic Church I go to, St. Faustina? And if I were to go to the Melkite Catholic Church down the street from me, would I be committing a sin, or what would happen if that happened?
Okay.
Well, so if it's a Melkite Catholic Church, it is at one of the Eastern, it's a member of one of the Eastern rites of the Catholic Church. In fact, the Melkite Catholic Church is based in Syria, but it belongs to the Melkite liturgical tradition. And you would not be sinning because they're fellow Catholics. So if you want to go there, you're perfectly welcome to. The Code of Canon Law provides that our Sunday obligations are fulfilled by attendance at a Eucharist celebrated in any Catholic rite. And so not only can you go there freely, you can fulfill your Sunday obligation there if you want. You should be aware that their customs are going to be a little bit different because they have a different liturgical tradition than the Latin rite, but it's another fully Catholic liturgical tradition, and you can participate fully. You can receive the Eucharist there. Just be sensitive to the way they do things. You know, you'll want to take cues like when to stand and when to kneel and things like that from the people around you. You know, as St. Ambrose advised St. Augustine, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. So when in a Melkite Catholic church, do as the Melkite Catholics do.
Oh, thank you so much, Jimmy. Thank you so much. I just have so much Catholic faith in me. I'm always trying to understand my prayer of a God. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, Johnny, we're always grateful when you call. Thank you for the call, and I look forward to speaking with you again sometime soon, I hope. You brought us right to the break, however, so I'm going to take the break and be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
As the largest religious media network in the world, EWTN has an important role in educating others about our Catholic faith and spreading the good news of salvation. We invite you to explore our numerous pages of historical faith documents, prayers, teachings, and other current issues in Catholicism today. Visit EWTN.com and click Catholicism. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum. Lent is less than 2 weeks away, and we invite you to join hundreds of people who are already taking the St. Peter's 20 Answers Challenge. Here's how it works. You visit shop.catholic.com today, pick up your St. Peter's 20 Answers sampler, a great collection of 30 books that you can pick up for a really great price right now, and then you begin your own version of St. Peter's 20 Answers Challenge. Reading all 30 books during Lent and Easter, that's about 90 days, and quite doable because each book is just 20 questions. If you want to give it a try, if you want to get your St. Peter's 20 Answers sampler at a great price, just visit shop.catholic.com right now and pick up yours. Shop.catholic.com. Going to Troutman, North Carolina, where Abraham is listening on iHeartRadio. We're glad you're here, Abraham. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
I want to be anonymous. No, I'm just kidding. No, my
you scared me so bad when you said that, because you are live on the air right now. Go ahead with your question.
Okay. I know how the Catholics view brothers and sisters of Christ.
Okay.
And my question,
because there's more than one opinion on that, but okay.
Yes. And one of the questions that I have asked of my pastor and deacons and things like that I've never really gotten a good answer that makes me more prone to believe the Catholic version of brothers and sisters is whenever Jesus gave his mother to the apostle to take care of, if Jesus would have had brothers and sisters, that responsibility should have gone to the second oldest. So mm-hmm. I guess my question would be, if Jesus did have brothers and sisters, how would that affect the Bible as we know it?
Well, Jesus did have brothers and sisters within some acceptable first century meaning of that term within the Jewish community. But what the question is, what kind of brothers and sisters were they? When we use the term brother and sister in English, we normally, and in almost every culture, you normally mean what's called a brother german, meaning a full brother. So same father, same mother. But everybody, including Protestants, agrees that is not what Jesus had. Jesus did not have brothers and sisters that had the same father and the same mother, because Jesus did not have a human father. You know, Joseph was his legal father, but it would not be possible for both Jesus and any other relatives to have Jesus's human father as their father, because he didn't have a human father. Therefore, brothers german or full brothers are not an option here. And that's the most common meaning of the term. So everybody has to acknowledge that, unless you disbelieve in the virgin birth, which of course our Protestant friends believe in, that we're talking about something other here than the normal kind of brother. This is a brother in an extended sense that doesn't involve the same father and the same mother. So there are a bunch of possibilities for what that could be. The one option that Catholics say is definitely not the case is that these brothers are children of Mary, that they're her biological children. And there are a variety of reasons for that. Some of them are based on early church writings that are part of apostolic tradition. Some of them are based on the Bible. They could be brothers in other senses. They could be adopted brothers that don't have either parent in common with Jesus. They could be step brothers through Joseph. They might be Joseph's biological children, the way Jesus was Mary's biological child, or they could be some kind of more distant relation, because in Hebrew speech, it was common to describe any male relative as a brother, unless you're descended from that male relative, in which case they called it your father, or unless that male relative is a descendant of yours, in which case they called it your son. So any relative that's male and is not one of your fathers and not one of your sons gets called a brother. in Jewish society. So that would include, you know, things like cousins and uncles and stuff like that, and nephews. So there are a wide range of possibilities. All the Catholic Church says is these ain't Mary's kids, biologically speaking. And there are indications of that in Scripture. You mentioned one of them, Abraham, where, you know, it doesn't make any sense at the cross in John chapter 19 as Jesus is dying that that they would be her biological children because Jesus entrusts the care of his mother to the beloved disciple, who is commonly identified as John. And it would make no sense to give Mary into the custody of an outsider if she had other biological children. In fact, that would be a colossal insult to her biological children to say, oh, for some reason, they're not reliable enough to take care of her. I'm giving her to an outsider. That would make no sense at all. And that's one passage in Scripture that does suggest, it doesn't prove, but it strongly suggests they weren't Mary's biological children. Another passage that does something similar is found in Luke 1, where the angel Gabriel shows up and says to Mary that you're going to be the mother of the Messiah. And at this point, Mary is an engaged, she's actually legally married. She's a betrothed woman. She and Joseph just haven't begun living under the same roof yet. The angel shows up, says you're going to be the mother of the Messiah. And instead of doing the normal thing, if she was planning on a normal sexual marriage, she would think, oh, well, in a few months when Joseph and I start living under the same roof, we'll have marital relations and then I'll become the mother of the Messiah. But she doesn't say that. She says, how can this be? Because I know not man, meaning I don't know any man in the biblical sense. And it sounds like she's not planning on it either. So this passage at least sounds like, because she obviously knows the birds and the bees, this passage sounds like she's not planning on a normal sexual marriage. And that's actually consistent with the earliest document that we have that addresses the question of who the brothers were. There's a document from the second century, so the AD 100s, known as the Infancy Gospel of James. It's also sometimes called the Proto-Evangelium of James. And according to it, Joseph, Mary was a consecrated virgin who had a vow of virginity, but she needed a guardian, and so Joseph was selected for her to be her guardian because he was an elderly widower that already had a family and that thus wasn't looking to start a new family. And according to the Infancy Gospel of James, that's who the brothers were. They were Joseph's children from a former marriage. And this would also be consistent with the idea of Joseph being quite a bit older than Mary, because he never appears on camera, so to speak, during Jesus's adult ministry. He appears to be dead by the time Jesus had his adult ministry, and you're not that likely to die if you've of anything other than a ripe old age if the great physician is your son. So it seems like Joseph may have well been quite a bit older than Mary, and the Infancy Gospel of James, even though it's not part of the Bible and is not inspired, it may accurately preserve some traditions from Jesus's family. But that's kind of a sketch of how I would look at the situation. Does that help you out, Abraham?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Abraham's on hold. Abraham, hang on a quick sec. Go ahead. Sure. That satisfy you?
That makes a lot more sense. I mean, you know, that answers the question a little bit, well, a lot more clearer than what I've been given in the past.
Oh, wonderful.
So I thank you.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Abraham, perhaps you'd like one of Jimmy's books. And I was thinking maybe The Bible is a Catholic Book.
Sure.
And if you'd like to hang on, that was a lovely call. I'd love to send you the book. We just give us an address and we'll send it out to you. The Bible is a Catholic Book. Let's go to Hunter in Missouri, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hunter, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call. My question has to do with the wealthy's obligation to the poor, specifically considering Pope Paul VI's encyclical that he wrote, Populorum Progressio, because in that encyclical he wrote, quote, No one may appropriate surplus goods solely for his own private use when others lack the bare necessities of life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so taken in isolation and literally, you know, that would seem to suggest that as long as there are people who lack life's necessities, it's illegitimate for people to own solely for their own private use anything that they don't strictly need. And now my gut says that that interpretation isn't what the church demands of the wealthy.
But yep, then your gut's right.
I'm still left wondering then, so what does it mean to say that no one may appropriate surplus goods solely for their own private use?
Well, I'd have to read it in context to see if there's more in the context that would shed light on the use of the term surplus. There may be something there. It's been a long time since I've looked at Populorum Progressio. But it has never been the church's understanding that one cannot accumulate wealth. There have been rich people all throughout Christian history, including in the Gospels. There were not many, but there were some wealthy Christians in the first century, and they were viewed as benefactors to the Christian community. For example, you had wealthier benefactors like Philemon, who was wealthy enough. He was a freedman. He didn't have a slave. He wasn't a slave, and he had a house that was big enough that the Christian church could meet there. And he did also have household staff. We know he had at least one slave named Onesimus. And so he was viewed as a benefactor in the Christian community, and he used his wealth, including his house, to host a church. And there are others as well. What one does not want to do, and the church has never said that wealthy people need to divest themselves of the goods they have accumulated until they themselves are poor. Now, you could take a kind of puritanical or rigorist approach to this and say, well, everybody ought to reduce themselves to the level of poverty as long as there are poor people. But that would actually be counterproductive, because it takes money in order to make money. And with wealthy people, a lot of what they have is invested. And, you know, technically they may have a certain amount of money that sounds large on paper, but really a lot of it is invested. And what that investment does is it allows other people to make money, and it allows the rich person to make money. And that allows everybody to become wealthier, to accumulate more goods and have more of the things they need in life. You know, for example, if all of the wealthy people divested themselves of everything down to the level of being poor, well, that would help a few poor people who received this money, but it would also dramatically crush the creation of wealth through the economy, because as George Bailey talks about in the movie It's a Wonderful Life, the money isn't just in the bank. It's being invested in people's houses and so forth, and people wouldn't be able to get loans that let them build houses, or wouldn't be able to get loans to start businesses, or wouldn't be able to get loans that enable them to make improvements in their business. And it's those houses and those loans and for businesses that enable people to lift themselves out of poverty. And so if you impoverished everybody out of a sense of I would have to say misguided fairness, then you would doom people to poverty, because there wouldn't be the money needed in circulation to generate new wealth and lift people out of poverty. In fact, the capitalist system has been the single greatest boon to mankind in terms of poverty ever in the last few centuries, just the last couple of centuries since the capitalist system really started spreading. Vast swaths of the world population have been lifted out of poverty that were totally impoverished prior to the emergence of a capitalist economy. And a capitalist economy requires there to be capital that is in the possession of individuals who are then able to invest it. And so the church doesn't have a problem with that. What it wants is for people to be reasonable in their approach to how much wealth they have, and that's going to vary from one individual to another. In you know, there are some people who achieve a certain level of comfort in life, and they can then, beyond that, you know, donate money to charity and help poor people and so forth in that way. Other people, though, may have a different strategy where they want to give people jobs and build really big businesses, and they may donate in their will. But for that strategy, you need to accumulate a larger amount of capital while you're still working, and that's not simply surplus.
Right back with more Open Forum.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answer's own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com, or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Matt Swaim here. Monday on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll celebrate the Feast of St. Agatha and take a look at This Week in Catholic History with Kevin Schmiesing. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and every line full. So back to the phones we go. Aaron is in Martin, Michigan, watching on Twitch. Aaron, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, I know that angels and angels can visually appear in front of people and talk, but mm-hmm. I'm wondering the stance on, do Catholics believe in ghosts, such as like apparitions visually appearing, like that could be captured on video or that other people can actually see? And these apparitions or ghosts, can they speak like angels? And then the last question is, in Protestant religion, we were taught that it can't be a human soul because it says in the Bible, like, after you die, you get judged, and then that's it. But so I'm wondering what Catholics believe on, can a demon physically appear like a ghost, and can it be captured on video, and can they talk? And basically, about the human soul, can one be a human soul, or is that just a Catholic teaching, or is that not a Catholic teaching?
Okay. So in regard to angels and demons, they are created spirits that have never been human, and they have more power than we do. According to a common Catholic opinion, and this is not a matter of church teaching, but it is a common opinion historically, angels and demons have what we today would call psychokinesis, or the ability of mind over matter. And so they, according to this common opinion, can sort of make temporary physical bodies for themselves out of matter. And thus they can interact with people in a material way, to where not only can you see and hear them, but you can also touch them, or at least you're touching the temporary body that they've made out of matter for themselves. And then when they no longer need the body, they let it dissolve. It ceases to be a body after that. So that's angels and demons. When it comes to human souls, well, Catholics and Protestants agree that when we die, our fate is determined, and that's pictured as a judgment experience. In Catholic circles, the judgment that occurs immediately upon death, or at least very quickly after death, is called the particular judgment, because it applies to particular people, and it's distinct from the general judgment that will occur at the end of time, which applies to people in general, everybody, once we get resurrected. According to the history of the word ghost, a ghost is just a spirit. That's, in Latin, the word for spirit is spiritus. In German, the word for ghost is Geist. English inherited both of those words, which is why we refer to the Holy Spirit sometimes as the Holy Ghost. So since Catholics believe in spirits, including God, who's a spirit, Jesus tells us, and including angels, and including human spirits, Catholics would say, yeah, ghosts exist, and some of them are human spirits. Can they appear to mankind? Well, according to the Catholic view, yes, human spirits, human ghosts, can appear to mankind. And the Church has even certified, because it has an investigative process to look into this, it's even certified some cases and said, yeah, there's good evidence that in this case, a human saint appeared to living people, and that's called an apparition. When a ghost or a spirit appears to people, that's what an apparition is. It appears. And they can appear using different senses. Now, the vast majority of saints do not currently have bodies, but they do have the ability to appear to the living, and that can take one of a number of different senses. It can involve the sense of vision, it can involve the sense of hearing, it can involve any of the standard senses. When that happens, there may be different degrees of realism that the apparition has. Sometimes people who see ghosts think they're seeing a living person. It's like they think they're seeing them with their eyes, and it's only when the apparition suddenly vanishes that they realize they weren't talking to a living person. Other people will see the apparition visually as kind of a shadowy figure or a transparent figure, or they may see the upper half of the body, but they may not see the feet, or they may see the apparition in their mind's eye rather than with their physical eyes. So those are all possibilities. In terms of which human souls might be appearing in apparitions, well, the Church acknowledges that saints, those who have passed through the particular judgment and are in heaven, they can definitely appear. It is a common opinion, although not a church teaching, that souls that are being purified after death, so they're on their way to heaven, they died in God's friendship, but they're still being sanctified, they're still being purified by Christ's grace, or they're in what Catholics refer to as purgatory, it's common opinion that they also can appear to the living in apparitions. And there are many reports down through Christian history of souls that are being purified, appearing to the living, and, for example, asking for their prayers. This happened, for example, with St. Thomas Aquinas's sister. After she passed on, St. Thomas Aquinas reported that she appeared to him and asked for his prayers, and he was happy to pray for her to help her in her journey of purification on her way to heaven. Then there's one other category of souls, and these are the ones who went through the particular judgment and didn't have a positive destiny. They're ones who were sentenced to hell. And according to some, including according to St. Thomas Aquinas, if God permits it, even damned souls can appear to the living. And there are accounts of that happening in church history as well. So on the Catholic view, it's certainly possible for saints to appear to us, people in heaven. It's also commonly viewed as possible for souls in who are being purified to appear to us. And it may even be possible for souls that are damned to appear to us if God allows it.
Aaron, thank you very much for the call and for the question. I hope that that was helpful to you. I hope that got to what you wanted. I'm going to keep going because still so many on the line. Oscar's in Houston, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Oscar, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, is it possible to get a sacramental Catholic marriage without obtaining a marriage license?
The Catholic Church wants its marriages to the marriages that it performs to conform to the local civil law, if at all possible. And so if a local jurisdiction, like let's say the state of Texas, ordinarily requires marriages to have a marriage license, then ordinarily the church will honor that. And so ordinarily you would need a marriage license in order to get married in the Catholic Church in those jurisdictions that require a marriage license for a marriage. There are exceptions to that because the civil law is not perfect and does not address all situations correctly. And so there are rare situations where a bishop could give permission for a clandestine marriage where the civil law is not followed, but that is very exceptional and only very rarely happens in very special circumstances.
Would perhaps a canon lawyer help out in a situation?
Yeah, sure. If you call marriage tribunal in your diocese and ask to speak to a canon lawyer, they can help you out with that, and you can advise them about the situation you're in, and they can talk to you about what possibilities might be available.
Thank you, Oscar. As I said, lines continue full, so I'm going to continue on. Jack's in Frisco, Texas, watching on YouTube. Jack, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. My question centers around angels, and it's sort of a twofold question. So the first one is, are angels created in the image of God? I know St. Thomas Aquinas thought so. And if so, then it kind of, I'm not really sure how to answer the question of why God wanted to make man after making angels, like image bearers of God who also had free will. I'm just not sure how to answer that.
Okay, so anyone that has some similarity to God bears the image of God to that degree. And so any created being that is in some way similar to God, that in some way represents God, that in some way illustrates something about God, has God's image to that extent. And frankly, that includes all of the creatures that exist, because all creatures display things about their creator. You know, St. Paul talks about how, for example, it's possible to deduce God's existence from looking at created beings. And so by looking at the creature, you can infer certain things about the creator. Therefore, there are certain points of similarity between the creatures and the creator. So in a sense, every created being bears something of the image of God. It may not be a lot, it's certainly not the way humans bear the image of God, but it bears something of the image of God, and that's going to include angels too. But the question for biblical purposes is, what does the image of God refer to in Genesis, where God creates man? And just because every creature bears the image of God doesn't mean that every creature bears the image of God in the same way. And therefore, God may have a special purpose for creating man in his image that's different than the way other creatures bear the image of God. And so angels, even though they bear the image of God in one sense, do not necessarily fulfill the role that God wanted mankind to in bearing his image when he created mankind. So we need to try to figure out, well, what does the image of God mean in Genesis? And there's been a lot of discussion on this that I can kind of summarize really quickly because we don't have a lot of time. And in fact, we're coming up on a break. But according to a lot of contemporary scholarship, the basic concept of the image of God in Genesis 1, where God creates man, is we're meant to be God's regent. We're meant to, the image of a king represented the king in the ancient world. So the image of Pharaoh represented the Pharaoh. And we are meant to represent God to his material creation. So we rule the material creation on God's behalf. And you'll notice that's exactly the next thing that God talks about in Genesis 1. He says, let us make man in our image and our likeness, and let him rule over the birds of the air and the fish of the sea and the land animals and so forth. So there's a connection in Genesis 1, just on a literary level, between mankind being an image bearer and mankind ruling the material part of creation, which angels are not part of. So angels don't bear even though they bear the image of God in one sense, they don't bear it in the sense of ruling the material creation on God's behalf the way mankind does. And so it seems to me that that's mankind's special purpose, and that, according to Genesis, and therefore that's the way in which mankind bears the divine image. We represent God as his regent, as his substitute ruler of the material creation, or his delegated ruler of the material creation. And that seems to be what the image of God in man is in this text, according to a lot of contemporary scholarship.
Which brings us right to the break, so I will leave it there. I hope that that was helpful to you. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul street evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
On Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Father Joseph and Doug Keck mine decades of phone calls answered by Mother Angelica. Mother dishes out teaching, advice, laughter, and plenty of prayers as she takes calls from her family.
Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Sunday afternoon, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and folks on the line, it's open forum, so any kind of question, welcome this hour. Abraham's in Atlanta, Georgia, watching on YouTube. I think this might be my first double Abraham day of my time here at Catholic Answers. Our second Abraham of the hour, go ahead with your question.
I have a question about annulments.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I know we as Catholics believe that Jesus said that, I might be misquoting, but that no man can dissolve what God has brought together.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, like, I'm having a difficult time, like, understanding, like, so how is it, like, our annulments, like, how do I know,
So an annulment is not a dissolution of a marriage. That's something different. What an annulment is a finding, after an investigation, it's a finding that a marriage never existed, that there was something, maybe through nobody's fault, but there was something about an attempted marriage that resulted in it not actually taking effect. And so consequently, even though the two parties may have thought they were married to each other, in fact, they never actually were. And this can happen through a number of different ways, but that's the difference between an annulment and a divorce. In a divorce, it's supposedly dissolving a marriage that really did exist. And in an annulment or a finding of nullity, it's investigating a situation and determining that actually the thing that looked like a marriage really was not a marriage.
Abraham, does that make sense to you? Oh, what line we got Abraham on?
Is line there? 5.
Abraham, does that make sense to you what Jimmy said?
Yeah, the only thing that I probably had like a difficult time is probably like, let's just say, for example, I get an annulment, and when I die, like, how do I know that God won't, like, tell me, like, that was the wrong thing to do?
Okay.
Well, the church takes this investigative process very seriously, and it requires a high level of expertise in order to be able to serve as a judge or as an attorney, a tribunal official in annulment cases. And they err, just like the civil court system does, they err on the side of caution. So they require pretty serious evidence for an annulment to be granted. They really want to make sure that the marriage really was null. Now, in this life, there are very few things that we can know with absolute certitude, and God knows that. So he doesn't expect us to have absolute certitude when we undertake an action. And consequently, he doesn't hold us accountable if we took reasonable precautions and just made a mistake. So in the case of an annulment, is it hypothetically possible that a marriage tribunal made a mistake and the marriage was valid? Yes, it's hypothetically possible. But if we're an ordinary layperson, we can look at the situation and say, well, they're the experts, I'm not. They looked at the situation and said that the marriage was not valid, and therefore it's reasonable for me to act on the assumption that it was not valid. Even though I don't have 100% guarantee, but life is about accepting risks. And so this is a reasonable risk to accept, and I don't need to worry about it. And God will understand if I'm making a mistake because I'm acting on the advice of experts. And a similar thing happens, in the medical profession. You know, if you have a medical condition that's serious and you go to a doctor, and the doctor says, in order to treat your condition, we need to give you this antibiotic. Okay, well, you've had a professional look at the situation, determine a reasonable course of treatment. There's a chance if you take the antibiotic, you might suddenly develop an allergy to it and die before anyone can help you. But that's a very small risk. And because you had an expert look at it and determine this is the best course of action, you need to take this antibiotic. Well, even if you're wrong and the antibiotic kills you, God's not going to judge you and say, oh, you should have disbelieved your doctor and refused to take the antibiotic because you didn't have evidence that your doctor was wrong. And in the same way, if you take the word of the experts on the marriage tribunal and say, okay, that marriage was null, so I can marry someone else, and you marry someone else, and the marriage tribunal happened to be wrong, God's not going to look at that situation and say, oh, you should have disbelieved the marriage tribunal any more than he would say, you should have disbelieved your doctor, because you didn't have evidence that the marriage tribunal was wrong, just like you didn't have evidence that your doctor was wrong. So we can safely and reasonably act on the judgment of experts, even though there's not a guarantee 100% that the experts are right. They probably are right, and that enables us to move forward making a reasonable decision based on what the experts have told us, but God will understand if it turned out in this case the experts were wrong and we were acting on advice that we were innocently given and had reason to believe.
Abraham, I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very much for the call and the question. Going to Virginia now. Teddy's in Virginia, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Teddy, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, gentlemen. Mr. Aiken, my question is in regards to redemption. I often hear priests say aught would have taken is a drop of Christ's blood to redeem the world. But I thought that it was just the total package of the passion that redeems us. Or is it just the physical substance of blood, of his blood?
So I would say that there's room for different opinions on this. I think that the one drop language that you sometimes encounter is based on the fact that Christ, the value of Christ's sacrifice was infinite. And so they want to point out that, you know, compared to Christ's sacrifice, human sin is minuscule. And so even the smallest part of Christ's sacrifice would have been sufficient to redeem the human race, because, you know, human sin is finite and Christ's sacrifice is infinite. So it's going to be massive. Christ's sacrifice is going to be massive compared to human sin. And therefore, that gets represented in terms of even one drop of blood would have redeemed the human race in terms of value. But I think that that it's also true that God willed that Christ's entire sacrifice, including his death and his physical suffering, played a role in redeeming us. So it might be hypothetically possible that a single drop of blood would have redeemed us, but it was actually God's will that the entire sacrifice, including the suffering of his flesh and the shedding of his blood and his death on the cross, all of that together actually played a role in redeeming us. So there's a question, there's a difference of the question, what would have been sufficient to save us? Maybe just one drop of blood. But what actually saved us was everything put together.
Teddy, that makes sense to you?
Yeah. What also led me to that was, you know, I think, hopefully I'm speaking right on this, the Mosaic Law, when animals used to be sacrificed and at the altar, and, you know, was it
there is a parallel between the death of the animal and the death of Christ. Yes.
Teddy, I'm gonna leave it there. Let's see if we can I'll read you this question. The caller wants to be off the air. What's the teaching on Catholics owning Jewish you might have to help me, tallits, is that how that's pronounced?
Yeah.
Are Catholics allowed to wear them?
Okay, so a tallit is a Jewish prayer shawl that's worn by men when saying certain prayers in certain settings in the Jewish community. The church does not have a teaching on this. And if one wanted to own one, one could certainly purchase one. The question would be, would it be appropriate to use it? And here, as a prayer shawl, you know, would it be appropriate for a Christian to like put it over his head and say prayers in this context? And here one runs into a bit of a conflict with St. Paul, because St. Paul has a passage in the Corinthian epistles where he contrasts the Jewish practice of men praying with their head covered, meaning with a tallit, with the Christian practice of men praying with their heads uncovered, which is why Christian men traditionally take off their hats when they're going to pray. So one would be rubbing against the grain of St. Paul, because he's making a point here that because Christ has come, we now pray with our heads uncovered as men. Now that's not something the church has taught we must do, but one would be kind of rubbing against the grain of St. Paul. Also, there have been statements by Christian bishops saying, look, this is a Jewish practice, and we don't want to really interfere with their territory. We don't want to appropriate Jewish things and take them out of a Jewish context. And so unless one were a Hebrew Christian, let's say, a Jewish Christian, I would counsel one to probably not use a tallit.
Thank you for that call, that question. Thanks to everybody who called today. That does it for us. Jimmy, thank you very much for another fine hour this week.
My pleasure, Cy Kelly.
And check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Today's episode is, as I recall, oh, now I'm time traveling again.
The Gospel of Jesus' Wife.
The Gospel of Jesus' Wife. Sorry, I was time traveling. I couldn't remember which one is today. Check it out at mysterious.fm, and that'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.